got a sprain or an itch, pain, rash, swelling, or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Now that we have two viable vaccines and more on the way, it seems that people are or will be becoming more lax about all precautions concerning safe practices to elude COVID-19 infection. Now, we've talked several times on previous shows about the vaccines that are now in distribution and are, in fact, being used across the country and the world to help prevent our suffering from the coronavirus that causes COVID-19.
We have, of course, had it drilled into our heads that hand washing, surface washing, and using masks are the main ways that we could, up until now, help ourselves to prevent our own infections and infecting others.
We've also been told that even though the vaccines are over 94% effective, even those who have had the vaccine will have to continue using masks, at least for the near future, whatever that time span ends up being, because they do not yet know if vaccinating a person prevents them from transmitting the virus to others.
Recently, it has also been revealed that the types of masks that the majority of the public use, including the surgical masks, are not as good as we had thought they are.
Indeed, even the surgical mask was originally created not to prevent the wearer, those being the surgeons and other healthcare workers in a surgical suite, from getting infected, but to prevent the patient from any bugs that the mask wearers could impart, especially into an open surgical wound.
Even with that in mind, the vast majority of scientists, physicians, and politicians are asking that we continue using masks until such time that we are all out of danger, or at least the risk of infection is way down.
There are still many who refuse to wear a mask, and many more who believe that the masks are useless, at least as far as protecting oneself. There are also those that feel that the masks are totally unnecessary. So today, Karen and I are going to look at some statistics from studies that shed a little different light on the utility and safety of using masks to protect ourselves and others from getting contact with the coronavirus.
No matter how strictly mask laws are enforced, nor the level of mask compliance, the population follows. Cases all fall and rise around the same time.
In an article written by Yinon Weiss and published on October 29th of this year, he starts off by saying that masks have become a political tool and a talisman. He also stated that when COVID-19 hit, governments panicked and created enormous fear. Now, Carmen and I are not presenting this as our own opinion. We are just relating the thoughts of another side of the issue.
Remember that the Centers for Disease Control currently estimated a COVID-19 survival rate of 99.99% for people younger than 50.
Many politicians, after a while, realized that their lockdowns were a political or policy disaster. So the solution very early was for people to put any old piece of cloth across their face and believe that it's okay to go out shopping again.
Certainly the wearing of masks is not just a small inconvenience, but it has actually become a key impediment to returning to a more normal life.
Well, masks do seem to dehumanize us and may in fact serve as a constant reminder that we should be afraid.
Look around you when you are driving. You will very often see single persons in cars wearing their masks with no one but other drivers, certainly more than 6 feet away.
There have been people spotted wearing masks while camping by themselves in the woods, or even on a solo sailing trip. Imagine all those pre-kindergarten and kindergarten children going to school, not just to learn, but to experience social interaction, being isolated from the other children and the adults with masks and plexiglass. It is indeed becoming a cruel world.
One of the easiest ways to contract the coronavirus is by passing the virus through our own hands. Of course, hand washing does help.
But wearing masks has actually increased the number of times humans touch their faces, thus passing any germs from the hands to the face, mouth, and eyes.
Remember when the U.S. Surgeon General and the Centers for Disease Control both previously said that masks are not effective in preventing the general public from catching coronavirus, only to later state that that was wrong information.
That in itself led to a credibility gap. Many officials, and not just politicians, actors and actresses, but scientists, such as Dr. Anthony Fauci, for example, have been caught maskless in many venues and far closer than the six-foot distance they purport everyone needs to keep.
Chicago's mayor and local media were all caught taking off their masks and violating social distancing as soon as a press conference ended.
Clearly, some people do not want you to see what politicians do behind the scenes. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, a strong advocate for mandatory masking, was caught off camera laughing about how wearing masks is an act of, and this is a quote, political theater. Now, I'm going to make a bold statement here and then try to show you the studies that corroborate it. The Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University summarized six international studies which, quote, showed that masks alone have no significant effect in interrupting the spread of influenza in the general population, nor in healthcare workers. That report also stated that the Oxford study indicated that despite two decades of pandemic preparedness, there is considerable uncertainty as to the value of wearing masks.
A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine stated that of healthcare workers in more than 1,600 hospitals showed cloth masks only filter out 3% of particles. That means that 97% remained.
This could all be taken with a grain of salt, except for the fact that multiple other studies show similar results. For example, studies published in the National Center for Biotechnology Information, Cambridge University Press, Oxford Clinical Infectious Diseases, and influenza journals are included in these. Studies do show masks can help in the case of direct respiratory droplets, which would matter if somebody is coughing, breathing, or sneezing directly on your face. Well, that happens normally in a very tight and highly confined space.
But the plentiful evidence indicates that masks will not meaningfully help with aerosol transmission, where two people are just in the same area or even the same room.
Unfortunately, we cannot show you any graphs visibly. We're on radio, but we can describe the results to you and let you be the judge and make up your own minds concerning the veracity of these study results. Austria was one of the first governments to require masks, and it did so after about 10 days after its cases began to go down. The level of downtrend did not change or improve after masks were required.
After the nation's people wearing masks for an extended period, cases are currently four times what they were when Austria mandated masks, and cases continue to climb.
Let's look at another European study. Germany. Germany mandated masks about halfway down its original recovery. Their cases are now similarly climbing quickly.
The French now have around 1,000% more daily cases they had when they mandated masks, despite having one of the highest mask compliance levels in the world.
Spain required masks when cases were near zero and had the highest compliance with mask wearing in all of Europe. Now Spain is at around 1,500% the level of cases compared to when it mandated masks. Of course, we do have to take into consideration other factors like the spreading of the disease across Europe and the world during this time, and perhaps it would have been even worse if mask use was not implemented.
After 3 months of requiring masks, the United Kingdom is at around 1,500% more cases, despite having one of the highest mask compliance records in Europe.
We could go on and on. Belgium required masks and may now possibly have the highest rate of cases in the world. Italy had extremely high levels of mask wearing despite no national mandate. And recently, skyrocketing cases finally compelled them to create one of the strictest mask laws in the world. But the results have predictably failed to show the rise in coronavirus cases. In fact, cases skyrocketed immediately after the mask mandate went into effect. And similar results occurred in other countries like Ireland, Portugal, and Israel. No matter how strictly mask laws are enforced, nor the level of mask compliance the population follows, cases all fall and rise about the same time. How about the United States? Americans have proven to be highly compliant with mask wearing, even higher than the Germans. It's therefore no surprise that the same trends found in Europe are also found in the United States states. For example, California required masks in June, but cases still went up by more than 300%, and the state remains heavily locked down 4 months later with still higher cases.
Hawaii suffered one of the most economically devastating lockdowns of all the U.S. states. It was also an early mover on mandating masks, both indoors and outdoors. But cases still went up by almost 1,000%.
With and without mask mandates, Texas and Georgia followed. Nearly identical case development. I'm looking at the two graphs put together on one sheet. They seem to follow the same curves, with and without strict mask adherence. So you may be asking, how about deaths? Are the masks lowering the death rate from COVID-19? Unfortunately, we again don't see a pattern of masks meaningfully helping.
So, you may be asking, why don't masks work? Common sense seems to say that they should. After all, at least some of the floating viruses are caught by the masks.
First of all, to answer the question, let's start with the masks themselves. Have you ever read the fine print on most of them? For example, on most consumer masks, you will see something along the lines of not intended for medical purposes and has not been tested to reduce the transmission of disease. Now, first of all, this is not to say that masks could not work. To work well, they have to be fully sealed, properly fitted, changed often, and have a filter designed for virus-sized particles.
This represents none of the common masks available on the consumer's market, making universal masking much less usable.
If we actually wanted effective masks, then manufacturers should have been conducting scientific tests evaluating masks specifically for their ability to reduce the spread of coronavirus. We've not yet seen one that's done this.
Has the ADA, the Food and Drug Administration of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, made any recommendations on which masks to use and approve masks based on their scientific efficacy? They have had a year to do that.
Now, there would be little point for the population at large to wear masks all the time, because while focused protection may be possible, it is not possible to eradicate the virus at this point or stop its spread. The problem is that many powerful institutions have too much political capital invested in the mask narrative at this point. So maybe the dogma is just being perpetuated.
The narrative says that if the cases go down, it's because masks succeeded. But it can also say that even if the cases go up, as they have, then it is because masks succeeded in preventing more cases.
The narrative simply assumes, rather than proves, that masks work, maybe even despite present scientific evidence to the contrary. The narrative further ignores places like Sweden and Georgia, which never required masks in the first place, and it suppresses new scientific evidence if it doesn't support desired political results, such as the data from the world's only randomized trial investigating if masks actually protect from the virus.
A funny statement was made by Martin Kulldorff, a professor at Harvard Medical School and a leader in disease surveillance methods and infectious disease outbreaks, as he described the current COVID scientific environment this way: after 300 years, the age of enlightenment has ended.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. We had to cut short our talk last week about the multiple types of cancer that are present in humans. So we'll use some of the time remaining on this show to quickly give you a rundown of some other types that you might have heard of. For example, lymphomas. This cancer actually begins in lymphocytes, the T cells or the B cells. These are really disease-fighting white blood cells that are just part of your immune system. In lymphoma, abnormal lymphocytes build up in the lymph nodes and the lymph vessels, as well as in other organs of the body. There are two main types of lymphoma. The first is called Hodgkin's lymphoma. Here, people have abnormal lymphocytes called Reed-Sternberg cells, and these cells usually form from the B cells.
And then there are the non-Hodgkin lymphomas, which also start in lymphocytes, but can grow rather quickly or slowly and can form from B cells or T cells.
You may have heard of multiple myeloma, which is a cancer that begins in your plasma cells. What are plasma cells? Well, it turns out that they are another form of immune cell that builds up in the bone marrow and forms tumors in bones all throughout the body.
For many years, melanomas were considered a very dangerous type of skin cancer. It begins in cells that become melanocytes. These are the cells that make melanin.
You know, the pigment that gives skin its color. Most melanomas form on the skin, but melanomas can also form in other pigmented tissues, such as the eye. In fact, wherever there is melanin. Brain and spinal cord tumors really are a group of several different types of cancers. For example, an astrocytic tumor begins in the star-shaped brain cells, which are called astrocytes, and these keep nerve cells healthy. It's still important to remember that brain tumors can be benign, meaning not cancerous, or malignant, in other words, cancerous.
There are even cancers that start in what are called the germ cells tumors, meaning tumors that begin in the cells that give rise to sperm or eggs. These tumors can occur almost anywhere in the body and can be either benign or malignant.
Some tumors release hormones and are called neuroendocrine tumors. Now, these tumors, which may make higher than normal amounts of hormones, can cause many different symptoms. They also can be benign or malignant. How about carcinoid tumors? You may not have heard of those. They're a type of neuroendocrine tumor as well, and they're slow-growing tumors that are usually found in the gastrointestinal system, the GI tract, and may spread to the liver or other sites in the body. Now, over the years, there have been a lot of myths that people believe in concerning cancers. We're going to try to bust those myths or prove them. One of the first questions asked is always, is cancer a death sentence?
In the United States, the likelihood of dying from cancer has dropped steadily since the 1990s. 5-year survival rates for some cancers, such as breast, prostate, and thyroid cancers, now are 90% or better.
And the 5-year survival rate for all cancers combined is currently about 67%. Of course, how long an individual cancer patient will live and whether he or she will die from the disease depends on many factors, including whether the cancer is slow or fast growing, how much the cancer is spread in the body, whether effective treatments are available, and the person's overall health, among other things. The next question that arises often is whether eating sugar makes a cancer worse. The simple answer is no. Although research has shown that cancer cells consume more sugars than normal cells, no study has shown that eating sugar will make your cancer worse, or that if you stop eating sugar, your cancer will shrink or disappear.
By eating Too much sugar can cause other problems such as excess weight gain and obesity, which are often associated with an increased risk of developing several types of cancer.
In our modern world, another question often pops up, and that is, do artificial sweeteners cause cancer? Now, this one's hard to answer since no actual studies have shown a definitive link between any of the artificial sweeteners and the increase in cancer. Now, there have been several studies over the years that have suggested this, since their studies did show a connection between the artificial sweetener that they were studying and cancer in laboratory animals, such as rats and mice.
A lot of people tend to stay away from friends and family that have been diagnosed with cancer, and it is because they are afraid that it might be contagious.
Well, is cancer contagious? I have to say no, but there is one caveat to this. The only situation in which cancer can spread from one person to another is in the case of organ or tissue transplantation. A person who receives an organ or tissue from a donor who had cancer in the past may be at risk of developing a transplant-related cancer in the future. However, even in this case, the risk is, well, extremely low. It's about 2 cases of cancer per 10,000 organ transplants. So doctors just simply avoid the use of organs or tissues from donors who have had a history of cancer. There are certain germs that can cause cancers. Here we're talking about some types of human papillomavirus, or HPV, for example, and bacteria such as Helicobacter pylori. So while a virus or bacterium can spread from person to person, the cancers they sometimes cause cannot spread from person to person. How about attitude? Positive or negative? Can it determine risk of or likely recovery from cancer? Now, that's a hard one to answer. But to date, there is no convincing scientific evidence that links a person's attitude to his or her risk of developing or dying from cancer. If you have cancer, it's normal to feel sad, angry, or discouraged sometimes, and positive or upbeat at other times.
People with a positive attitude may be more likely to maintain social connections and stay active, and physical activity and emotional support may help you cope with your cancer.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and old lang syne? For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. And surely you'll be your pinstop, and surely I'll be mine, and we'll tack a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll tack a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. We two I run around the braes and powd the gowans fine, but we've wandered many a weary fit sin old lang syne. For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll tack a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. We two hae paddled in the burn frae morning sun till dine, but says between us braid hae roared sin old lang syne. For old lang syne, my dear, for old lang syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for old lang syne. And there's a hand, my trusty fear, and gies a hand o' thine, and we'll tack a right rude willy wat for auld lang syne. For auld lang syne, my dear, for auld lang syne, we'll tack a cup o' kindness yet for auld lang syne.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.